From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. Hope that you are doing exceedingly well out there and are having a fantastic start to your week, which is not, I am happy to report, as cold as it normally is. Perhaps we are on our way to spring. One never knows. But it certainly is hot in the studio because, as always, we have a number of important, lively and exciting topics for you on the show today. So what are we talking about? Let's get into it. Later on, we're going to be talking about the national dialogue. In fact, this show is pretty much all about dialogue. I mean, I suppose all shows are about dialogue, if you think about it in a sort of meta way. But we are talking about the general dialogue in the Jewish world and in the general world in South Africa. And so we're going to be talking about the question of the national dialogue versus the question of what the country is doing. And we're going to ask ourselves, is accountability starting to seep into the system around the national dialogue? Is it a symbol of the way things are going? So that is one question. We're going to be reflecting on Limud. I was at Limud this weekend, and you can always get a sense of the dialogue in the community that's going on via what was going on at Limud. So that will be a discussion point. We're going to be talking about the neo-neocons. If you don't know what that means, stay tuned. But a kind of a political phenomenon that I think might start to affect us going forward. You've heard me talk about it before, but there will be some additional stuff I want to chat about. And then in a light note, we're going to talk about the drone that's helping everybody keep Shabbos. So that is what is going to be on the show, more or less. You know, we might dip into something else if we feel that it is worthwhile and appropriate. And of course, the only other worthwhile and appropriate thing to also do is to for you to be part of the conversation, because we do, if it is a conversation, like to have you engaged. So you can send us a WhatsApp, 0618951019. That's 0618951019, 0618951019. And we'd love to hear from you. I did speak at Limud to a number of Chai FM listeners who found me, and we had a good chat, so it was really nice to see all of you there. And if you had a good time, do let us know on the WhatsApp line. Be good to hear from you as well. So let's talk about what was at Limud this year to get ourselves a pulse about where the South African Jewish conversation is at the moment. As you probably know, if you were listening to the station in the last couple of weeks, Limud was advertising very heavily. It's an educational, cultural event that happens. And basically, if you've never been, it's sort of like every hour you get to choose from a smorgasbord of 10 or different lectures most of the time, or activities. Not all of them are lectures, presentations. And it can be anything from religious stuff and Torah to philosophical things to arts and culture to politics to history, Israel, the Holocaust, Yiddish even, and all of these are available, and you basically choose to see what you want to go see, and then off you go. And it goes over an entire weekend, and then there's like a Shabbat element to it. So if you want to come and stay over for the Shabbat, you can. Otherwise, you people come for the Sunday. And this year actually was a record number on Limud. So for the Shabbat, it was nearly 600 people, and I think it was another 300 on the Sunday. So close to 900 people coming out for Limud this year. And what was on the agenda? Well, that's the real question, because the program that is designed over the course of 9 months. So it's kind of a reflection of what has been going on sort of in the year. and what is on people's minds, as well as who are the international speakers that often come out for this thing that have a particular bearing on that program. And in fact, this year, they didn't even invite a particular group. Some of the groups that they invited just happened to be in the country. So they were joined by a number of rabbis who were here for the G20. The G20 has a sort of interfaith element to it. And so there were a number of Israeli rabbis who were here as well, and they joined Limud. So that was a sort of extra interesting batch of people that came out. So what were some of the things that that people were talking about? So where is the pulse of all of this going? So obviously Israel is forefront in everyone's minds at the moment. And that was a big and quite a tense, I would say, discussion point at Limud this year. There were people, one of the things that they try and do is get everyone from different perspectives there. And they really managed to achieve that this year. I have to say, there was a sort of journalist from the right wing, more center and center right papers, so like Jerusalem Post and Jewish Insider. And then they had people who were on the extreme left, so writers for Haaretz, who really are looking at stuff very specifically, people who are just not writers but are living in different towns in Israel, and also guys who are living in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank. The one guy was the head of a council of a settlement. So really, that was quite a broad range, and there was quite a few in between, and quite tense discussions actually. On all of those, if you went to any of those kind of panels, unsurprisingly, people had strong views, whether they were on the left or the right. And what I think was the most interesting, though, is that every year they sort of take all the Israelis and put them on one giant panel and have them debate things. And that was a very difficult and tense discussion. But what one of the people actually said was, actually in Israel, it would probably be difficult to have someone from a kind of settlement and someone from Haaretz on the same platform actually having a proper debate with one another, and that could sort of only occur because they were now all in South Africa. So that was kind of interesting, and I thought gives you a pulse, and it's important to give people an outlet so that they know exactly, you know, what was going on. And besides the actual Israelis, there was quite a lot of other discussions of people who were talking about the history of Israel, talking about the issue of boycotts, the issue of how people targeted Israel, the history of the Maccabean Revolt and Hanukkah, and how Israel's treated in the international community. So there really was, I think, quite a strong part of that. I suppose that's not surprising as people are trying to figure out where this goes next and what to talk about. These are discussions that are taking place, and in a more kind of nuanced way than even a year ago. I remember Limud had to do after October 7th. It was difficult to have certain kinds of views because it was just hard for people to talk about. The tragedy was still so raw, and it hasn't finished yet. But you're already starting to see that the discussion shift somewhat in a new direction. So that is your initial thing on Limud. We're going to take a short break and come back. We'll be talking about some of the broader issues beyond Israel that was being spoken about this year.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. And we've just been doing a little bit on Limud and talking about what were some of the big conversations on the conference this year, to try and give people a bit of a viewpoint about where things were going. Another sort of, I guess, important and maybe unusual story that maybe you wouldn't have expected was this question of interfaith at Limud this year. As I said, there were these rabbis that came out for the G20 who were doing interfaith work, and they actually presented about how they have been engaging different Muslim populations throughout the Middle East, and really bringing faith and the commonalities that people of faith have with one another into the discussion. And so that was very interesting, just to get a sense about how, you know, in the West there has been this kind of problem of those societies taking very harsh views against Jews in Israel, whereas the Middle East, it's definitely shifting, even amongst the violence that we're seeing in Gaza. And so they were bringing quite a big perspective. Another one which was very interesting was a guy who focuses on a historical dialogue between Muslim and Jewish populations, particularly in places historically like Syria. And he gave some very interesting insights into how Jews and Muslims actually engaged one another, and told some individual personal stories about in different times in the past where these interactions occurred and what they looked like and how people got around some of the religious issues and what were some of the key things. So that was extremely interesting to hear about a Muslim qadis, judges, who were friends with great rabbis, and then they would have these engagements. And also other Jewish figures throughout history who had to engage with the powers of the day. So this guy, his name was Alan Verskin, who was the one of the speakers. He did a whole thing on the history of a guy called David Ruveni, who was a man who was described as being Abyssinian, in other words, Ethiopian, but Jewish Ethiopian, although not necessarily from that community that we might know. And he basically decided that he was the sort of Messiah, and he was going to bring all the Jews back to Israel. And he kind of went around the world convincing and trying to convince the Ottomans and the Christians and different groups to send him arms so that he could bring the Jews to Israel. And in the end, it didn't work, but it was a very interesting kind of early attempt in the 1600s to try and find Jews on the way out. So that was another interesting part, is that there was actually this question about dialogue, even amongst the war, about dialogue between Jewish and Muslim populations. And we're seeing sort of hopefully more of that going forward as we do. So that was another interesting element. Another cool aspect, I think, was the importance of art this year. There is always art in the program. And typically that is in the form of music, which was a big part of the program this year. But also there was this question of monumental art, so large-scale artwork pieces, and Jews are involved with kind of changing cityscapes and all of that, not just art as you might expect to see it on a different sort of piece of paper. And so there were two artists, one from the UK, one from Cape Town, and sort of both in the same ways doing art. So the one guy is a sculptor, and he builds massive sculptures in for festivals or for sculpture parks or for corporates, and they have all of these sort of, I don't want to use the word, sort of new agey kind of look, almost pagany. I don't mean that in a sort of derisive sense. It's kind of, they have this kind of, the only way I could explain it would be if the movie Avatar was a statue. It kind of looks like that. You've got these very big humanoid type people and figures, and they get put out, and they're anywhere between 5 and 12 meters high, and so they really sort of transform the landscape. A guy by the name of Daniel Popper, you can go see his stuff on Instagram, and that was really interesting to see how he puts some of this stuff across and some of the themes that he used. And on the other side, the British guy, a guy called Leon Fenster, he is an artist who draws a kind of, can imagine kind of like Where's Wally type things, basically telling large scale stories about cities and people's lives and corporates in a sort of big multi-layered kind of artistic piece. And he's even done things like Ketubas and Haggadahs, and also he really sort of brings his Jewish identity into the way that he writes things. And it's, yeah, this is kind of a very interesting very interesting thing from the perspective of how Jewish artists are interacting with some of their stuff at the moment. So that was very interesting. And on the song side, there was a lot of Yiddish that was being discussed. So a chap called Anthony Williams, he is an African American singer of Yiddish, and he did a fascinating discussion about the role that black music plays in Jewish prayers, and the kind of tunes that we use for our prayers, where they come from, and how sometimes sort of the contribution that black music has made has integrated itself into Jewish songs and prayers, which is extremely interesting. And of course, Yiddish as well, which was kind of fascinating. So, and actually I'm hoping at the end of the show to maybe or either the show or another show to actually play you something that might be like that, which I think might be particularly interesting. So with regards to that, stay tuned for that. And then of course there are other we have Yiddish singers in our community, and they came and they did songs on about that, which was kind of interesting. So those were some of the cultural elements, and I think it was a kind of fascinating insight into where the community is at, and that's besides some of the Torah aspects. There was Gela Fine, who was the editor of Rabbi Sachs's works, so she kind of spoke on some different elements as well. And we had Rabbi Cholo, who was talking about a debate in Jewish law and in general in Israel. And so I think a lot of it was that as part of the discussion in terms of this. So that was on Limud. Well done to everyone put it together. And thank you for all the Chai FM listeners who came. And let us, we'll go forward and see what we can do with it. Hopefully those discussions continue, because that is what we are about as a radio station. Now, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics for Adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having regular wellness checks such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care, find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside Dis-Chem Pharmacies. Better health starts here. Now let's talk about a dialogue of a different kind at the moment. We have the national dialogue going on at the in South Africa with President Cyril Ramaphosa, and it has so far seemingly seemed to be a bit of a dog show. We have protesters outside. We've got people who have been kind of walking onto stage randomly and confronting other people. The most important incident so far has been when one of the news anchors accused one of the spokespeople of the ANC of eating too many sandwiches, and this caused an incident of fat shaming. We've had lots of organizations pull out. I've spoken about that last week. And so where does this national dialogue go? And it seems to me that a lot of people are accusing the presidency of actually not taking this thing seriously and using it more as a campaign tool for the upcoming elections than a serious dialogue. You'll note that the group of eminent persons that is on the list contains very few opposition figures. No one, for example, who the government seems to have a problem with, like the Afrikaans community, was on. So there's been a problem around this question of dialogue and where it's going. But I think what it actually does, and what's actually telling us, is that maybe we don't need so much of a dialogue, because what we're starting to see is accountability in the system, right? So George was talking, the AI, about the fact that the city is removing one of its bylaws, which was problematic from a CCTV perspective. We had the firing of a minister for the first time or second time, actually, only in the history of in the history of South Africa, because she had put corrupt people onto a process of what's called the CETAs. I won't go into it, but basically it was a basically we're just putting ANC people onto what was supposed to be a public body. We're seeing all of these sorts of things, and there's a couple of other examples which I could know. The budget was another one, where actually how the process is supposed to work is that you have more voices and there's accountability and people have to discuss things. So instead of having some giant dialogue, which they're doing, you have micro dialogues around the budget. How do we get the budget so that everybody agrees with it? How do we appoint people to boards so that everyone agrees with it and it's not corrupt? How do you make sure that the CCTV process works in the city? And because the ANC is no longer in charge, they can't fight on every front. And so you're starting to have these sort of wins in different places. And that's the true dialogue, I think, that's happening. This national dialogue, what may or may not come of it, who knows? But actually, South Africa has entered a period of dialogue where different interests are, and it's difficult. They shout at each other and they're angry and whatever. And there's all this stuff that happens on Twitter. But actually, people are forced to listen. We saw this with Leila Khaled Drive, right, where the ANC tried to shove through this way of trying to rename something after Leila Khaled, and the combination of the international relations, which is I want to talk about a bit later on, and whatever, all contributed to them effectively dropping that idea. So not everything's perfect. We need more economic growth, whatever. But one of the things that we're seeing a kind of year on from the GNU is that there is some more accountability in the system. And this is ultimately a good thing going forward. Now, I just did want to bring you back to this question of dialogue and discussion and the question of black engagement in Jewish music. And one of them is from this guy called Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was an internationalist. He was a cultural critic and an activist. He was quite a severe communist at some point, even a Stalinist, although he did change his mind on that. He was also a very big Zionist, and he used to like playing different songs for Jews, and he even went in 48 to go play for the troops. And so because of this discussion that we've been having around dialogue and culture and whatever, I thought let's take a kind of a detour here and listen to Paul Robeson, an African-American man, singing the Partisan song, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. Have a listen to this.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Now, we're going to talk about an evolving situation that we're going to be seeing probably over the next, I don't know, half a decade, maybe more, for American Jews. And what is it going to mean for them? Because by all accounts, and hands up, we did get this wrong in Canada, so maybe we get this wrong in America, but it does look like this guy, Mahmoud, that's his dad, Zoran Mamdani, is going to win the elections in November in America, in New York, rather. And this guy is an extreme BDS activist. He's a socialist. He wants to provide government-owned grocery stores, make the all transport in the city for free. He wants to impose government housing on different people in the city, which is not such a simple thing to do. And he's kind of in a long sort of long line of radical mayors. He wants to defund the police, although he seems to be less concerned about that now. As I said, when he's in his previous job as an assembly member in New York State, he wanted to make certain kinds of donations to Israel illegal. So this is the guy who's likely to win the election come November in New York. Okay, and you're talking about the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, and typically it was an important constituency in being able to fight back against candidates like this. And interestingly, the other important candidate population was the African-American population. And basically, these are the two groups that didn't vote for this guy, but he has been able to put together a coalition of single white young people who are struggling with the cost of living in the fashionable parts of Manhattan, as well as the Latino community and the what they call in America South Asian, what they sort of mean is Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Indian, etc., who've been able to mobilize on this guy's behalf. And he has a kind of winning electoral coalition here that he can use to drive things forward. And the reason he's an interesting phenomenon is that what we're seeing, despite what the mainstream media is saying, is that Jews are considerably concerned about what this guy is and what he represents. And about out of base, there are people who do support him in the Jewish community, about 2 out of every 10, but the majority of people don't. And those majority of Jews are Democrats, right? New York, if you live in New York, you're basically a Democrat. I think Republicans typically only get something like 80% of the vote. 80%. It goes to the Democrats, only get sort of 10 to 15%, maybe 20% of the vote. And so Jews are often going to be Democrats. And they look at this guy and they say, well, this is not really what we want. We're Democrats, but we're not progressives or socialists. And it reminds me of a similar thing that happened to Jews in America in the 1960s. There were all of these Jews who were left-wing, and they were in the labor unions and part of social groups and socialist groups. But more and more what happened is that being associated with these groups meant that you were required to kind of support Stalin, right, and communist Russia. And these were all people who had fought in World War II, for example, or the Korean Wars, or even Vietnam. And they were coming home and they were kind of proud to be American soldiers. They liked America. They knew what America had done for them as an open society for Jews, where there was basically very little anti-Semitism. And they were proud of their country and proud of democracy and proud of kind of liberal values. And they wanted to keep all of that, but they were kind of what you might call economic left-wingers, in that they still believed in certain kinds of safety nets or help for people or whatever it is. But they were basically socialists, but on the international front, they were uncomfortable with where the left in America was going. And so they started breaking away. And so you had this development of a group of people who were left-wing at home but right-wing abroad. And that was the nascent creation and the start of a group of people called the neocons. Now, if you know the word neocon at all, it's kind of associated with grumpy Bush-era people who invaded Iraq. But the genesis of those guys, this kind of American interventionism, militarism, interest in democracy, small limited government, they all came from this group of disaffected left-wingers who sort of got increasingly frustrated with where the left wing was going, and then when Reagan came along, he had this group of people called the Reagan Democrats, people who had voted Democratic their whole lives, and then suddenly couldn't stand the other candidate and voted for Reagan and never went back. And I think that what you're going to start to see is a start of that process again. Jews who are not necessarily MAGA, don't necessarily like Donald Trump, but do not like where the Democratic Party are going, I'm going to find new ways and organize in new fashions to start to push international relations, which is kind of pro-Israel, pro-democracy, not pro these third world tin pot dictatorships, and instead still have to deal with a Democratic Party that they are uncomfortable with. And this is, you know, something that we've had to deal with as a Jewish community here for a long time, because the government obviously is so hostile in terms of Israel and sometimes in terms of the community as well. So you've sort of had to learn how to handle that. But it's a kind of new experience for American Jews, and one which they have had before and they're going to have to engage with. And you've seen versions of this, guys like Shabbos Kirstenbaum, who started out as a Bernie Sanders supporter and now is a Trumpist. So he's not necessarily so much of a neocon, but he's got some other questions. There is Bill Ackman, who is a billionaire that has sort of had this thing. It's not just on the Israel issue. You've got the way that trans rights are spoken about, the way that environmentalism is approached, the way that people have having children, all of these sorts of things. all a big part of the program. So watch out for a Neo-Neocon coming to your screens in about 5, 10, 15, or maybe 20 years from this conversation. So that's extremely interesting. Talking about tin pot dictatorships, I see that we sent our top general to Iran. And then not only is that like problematic enough, where he reviewed some of the really elite forces of Iran, some of those that are involved in propping up this kind of very dodgy regime. But then he sort of went into the realm of politics and started talking about what was going on in international relations, talking about how South Africa and Iran are the same thing, and we want to fight against arrogant imperialists, all sorts of other rhetoric. And interestingly, the government has sort of come out as a bit of a fright, and they said, oh, well, we didn't know he was going, and he wasn't supposed to say sorts of these things. And I mean, I suppose as a general, he really isn't supposed to say these sorts of things. Military people are not supposed to freelance in foreign affairs. They have to do their jobs to defend the country. Quite what they're doing in Iran, nobody knows, because they doubtfully are defending anything over there. But what was interesting is actually what the general was saying is completely true, in the sense that this is what the South African political system actually thinks from an ANC perspective. Like, if you had put what he had said into any other context, then it would have been completely fine. It just happened to be that it was a general saying this, but if Ronald Lamola had said it, for example, or whatever, then it would have been exactly what the ANC is thinking. And now they've backed off on this. And the reason they've backed off on it is because they're having to do a discussion with the Americans around a trade deal, and you don't want to be seen to be footsieing about with the Iranians in a military capacity, just by the way, whilst you're doing this sort of thing. And so the ANC has taken fright and said, oh, we distance ourselves from this. And I think that this is important, because a lot of people are saying, oh, well, this pressure from the Americans is just going to make people angry. They're not going to shift. It shows you the ANC shifts if you put them under pressure on the right stuff. I think more pressure is going to be part of the conversation, not less. And it links to our discussion about accountability that we were sort of having more on the domestic sphere previously. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome back to the program. Hope that you are having a fantastic day. And just to end off, I thought we would talk about the drone that saved Shabbat, which is kind of an interesting question. So apparently in the town of Ofakim, there was a problem recently, where workers noticed that the Eruv around the city was down. Obviously the Eruv is there to make sure that people can enjoy Shabbat. They can carry outside, which is what the Eruv helps. It provides a halakhic basis for people to be able to carry outside and not just indoors. And city workers noticed that they had this break in the Eruv, that is this kind of fence around the area. So now they had a problem and had to do something. So basically the damage was identified. And normally issues require immediate physical intervention, but the time was very short until Shabbat was about to begin. Basically, in a consultation with the local rabbis, a decision was made to use a drone to go out and restretch the wires that created the Eruv. And they had a rabbi on hand who sort of was adhering to this and sort of was not operating the drone. I don't think it was a drone operating rabbi, but he sort of was creating making sure everything was done according to the way it was supposed to be done. And it was operated, and then they sort of stretched it. And The Ministry of Religious Services were happy with the move. They said the use of advanced technologies is an integral part of our vision for excellent religious services. And the case in Ofakim demonstrates how innovation can ensure full compliance with halakha, even under challenging conditions. So that is, that was part of what it is. And they obviously work very hard to try and make sure that the Eruv is always up so people can enjoy their Shabbats in peace and tranquility, which is certainly the idea. And all this technology, who knows? We have AI George. Are we going to have an AI rabbi? I don't know. It may happen. You just never know. But in the meantime, at least drone technology can help us make sure that we have an Eruv in time for Shabbat. So that is... that is that particular story, just a lighter item to end off today, which is, in fact, what we are doing because we have come to the end of the show for today. Thank you to Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, Vusi, who is on the sound, and to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week. Do join us again next week on the New Blue Review.